All right, now let me give you a contemporary analogy, an example of the argument from contingency, which is the fundamental Aristotelian proof for the existence of God. It's the summation of the traditional proofs. Remember what this basic Aristotelian argument is. It's that everything in the world is dependent, unable to explain itself, and therefore you've got to go beyond the world to explain the world. You can symbolize the whole argument by writing the word contingent and then an arrow from contingent to absolute with a capital A. Or dependence, arrow, independence with a capital I. In the field of physics, and more specifically the engineering field of thermodynamics, there are three fundamental laws which are regarded as basic to the operations in those realms. These are called the three laws of thermodynamics. And the second law of thermodynamics has to do with irreversible energy processes in closed systems. The second law of thermodynamics has to do with irreversible energy processes in closed systems. Now, I've discussed this in the introductory essay in Christianity for the Tough-Minded. So you can refer to this if you find this a little tough going. It also is included, this essay, in The Suicide of Christian Theology. The essay is entitled, Is Man His Own God? So those are two places that you can get at this. All right. The second law of thermodynamics talks about what happens in a closed system left to itself as far as energy is concerned in such a closed system where you have no additional energy being fed in. There is a continual loss of available energy. There is a decline in available energy in such a closed system. The term for a decline of available energy, the term used by physicists is an increase in entropy. Entropy, E-N-T-R-O-P-Y. Entropy is the loss of available heat, the loss of available energy. That's what entropy refers to. Okay, in a closed system where no energy is being fed in, you have increasing entropy.
Loss of heat?
If it's heat energy you're talking about, depending upon what type of energy you're dealing with. Let's take heat energy. That's a perfectly simple device. You have a closed system, a compartment, and you have heat energy in it, right? All right, if there is no feeding in of additional energy, there will be a continual decline in the available heat energy in the system. There will be an increasing entropy, a decreasing amount of available energy, until finally the system arrives at the zero point relative to energy. That zero point is popularly called heat death. Heat death. Where there is no more available energy. Think of your automobile, old flivver, all right? Now, you are crossing the desert, and before you cross the desert, you stop at a gas station, and there the gas man pumps into the tank of old flivver gas, and you then have available energy. You start crossing the desert. There is no opportunity for any more gas to be put into the system. It followeth like the night the day that eventually the tank will empty, there will be no more available energy, and old flivver will come to heat death. Maybe you will too if you didn't bring any water with you. But anyway, second law of thermodynamics speaks in those terms. What's the importance of this? For the atheist, the universe is like that system. Because for the atheist, the universe is all there is. The energy that's in it now is all the energy there's ever going to be. Now, the second law of thermodynamics says that you will reach heat death in any system in a finite length of time. That's just another way of saying that you'll reach heat death, because if it were to take an infinite length of time to reach heat death, then of course you'd never actually reach it, in which case this would not be the statement of the law. The law says that in a finite length of time, you are going to get to heat death. All right. Now, for the atheist, the universe has always been in existence. Obviously. Because if it had been created, he wouldn't be an atheist. Okay? The universe has been in existence forever. But it is a closed system. That is to say, there are no sources of energy outside it that feed into it. According to the second law of thermodynamics, such a system will nonetheless reach heat death and will reach heat death in a finite period of time. But notice what this means necessarily. It necessarily means that the atheist's assumption is wrong, because his universe has already had an infinite period in which to reach heat death. His universe never had a beginning, right? So there has been more than enough time for heat death to have arrived. Now, it's fairly evident that it hasn't arrived, because he at least has enough energy to discuss the question. The universe has not come to heat death. So there's something the matter with his assumption. And his assumption is either or both of the following. The universe was never created, and or nobody outside is feeding energy in. All right. In order for the universe not to have come to heat death, one of two things must be the case, one or both. Either the universe has not been around forever. In other words, it was created a finite time ago, and that's why it hasn't gotten to heat death. It hasn't had enough time yet. And or there is a cosmic gas station attendant out there someplace feeding in energy, and that's why it hasn't gone to heat death. Or both, you notice. But one or the other of these must be the case. Either there must be energy feeding in from the outside of the universe, and or the universe has not been in existence forever. Now, this is not a cute theological interpretation that has been put on the second law of thermodynamics by some theologians who want to play apologists or anything like that. This is a necessary conclusion of the law itself. And I refer you to the standard text on thermodynamics issued by Wiley in Philadelphia and authored by Gordon J. Van Wylen. Van Wylen, capital V-A-N, capital W-Y-L-E-N. Van Wylen is the dean of the School of Engineering at the University of Michigan. And this is a standard thermodynamics text. In this text, Van Wylen says, My co-author and I want to go on record as believing in the existence of God. We go on record because we cannot say anything else in light of the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics compels us to assert the existence of an infinite source of energy outside of the universe in order to be able to operate with the second law of thermodynamics. Now you say, but what's that got to do with proof from contingency? Well, think about it for a moment. This is nothing but a physical illustration of contingency. It's taking energy as the particular stuff of the world that you're examining, instead of taking motion or ethics or whatever. It's taking energy. And it's noting that energy can't explain itself. Energy will run down, and it'll take only a finite length of time for it to run down. Thus, when you examine energy, it requires your appealing beyond the universe that you are in to an infinite source of energy. You say, but why can't I just appeal to a finite source of energy a little bit more powerful in our present universe? How about a universe that's a little bit more energetic than our universe, and that's feeding into ours? Remember the infinite regress? If you appeal to universe to the second power to explain our universe, you're then going to have to go to universe to the third power, to the fourth power, dot, 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 to universe to the nth power. And if you keep this system going like that, you're never going to be able to explain any of the subsequent universe terms in this. You're going to have to stop somewhere. But why not stop with our universe right here and now? Why go on and predicate an infinite source of energy beyond it? Answer: would you prefer to kid yourself into thinking that our present universe is actually an infinite source of energy when all the empirical evidence says that it isn't? You see, in order to say that our universe somehow is able to handle this, you've got to go against the evidence for the second law of thermodynamics. You've got to kid yourself into a different view of our universe. Isn't it more reasonable to go beyond our universe, which shows energy contingency, to a source of that universe for which you don't have to assume such a thing? This is a direct application of the contingency argument in physics, and it did not arise by some sneaky Thomist playing physicist. That isn't how the second law of thermodynamics came about. Second law of thermodynamics is the result of independent work in the area of physics. It's simply an illustration of how sound the contingency argument really is. It's a modern day application of that. Another comment that's often made on this is, but couldn't you have a steady state universe? A steady state universe in which over here you have sort of one segment of the universe which is feeding into this over here, and after this feeds
down, then this into this, then this will feed down into that. So you have a sort of reciprocity and a continual reduction in energy here and a gain in energy here, and then the reverse. Well, the answer to this is that that doesn't very well explain the whole thing. You still have exactly the same problem relative to the whole thing. It's like the analogy that I've sometimes used. Suppose you want to solve your financial problems by having two bank accounts instead of one. All right? It's very depressing to you to see one bank account go down. So you take the money that your father sends from home and you put it into two bank accounts. All right? And you make sure that you only take the money from the first bank account to put into the second. Okay? And then when the money seems to be going down in the second, in the first, and up in the second, you take the money from the second and put it into the first, so that you can always see a bank account that has money in it. Now, does this actually solve your financial problem? Not in the slightest, because if your father is only giving a certain amount of money, and you are spending any money from either of these bank accounts, eventually you're going to reach economic death. See? If no more money feeds in from the outside, you're still going to end up broke, regardless of how often you transfer money back and forth from one account to the other. You're only kidding yourself if you make those transfers. You haven't actually solved the problem. The only way you can prevent monetary death is by having an outside energy source feed it in to replace what's declined and disappeared. Yeah.
Well, it's not directly related to apologetics, but those who, for instance, these professors of the text, having seen that they have to accept God because of the second law, it really doesn't have anything to do with the fact that there can still be heat death, does it? There was a supply can still run out and still admit in God as being the infinite source. Is that true? So the two don't necessarily tie in, do they? The end of it as opposed to the beginning?
Do you mean once you have admitted that there is a God who supplies energy to this situation, does that mean that you're not going to have heat death? Answer: no, it does not mean that at all, because you don't know whether that God is going to keep supplying energy sufficient to keep the universe on an even keel. And I take it from Scripture that there is no assurance of that. There is going to be a new heaven and a new earth. There is going to be a transformation of things, and this present world system is eventually going to grind down.
I presume that none of these scientists that would come to that conclusion would necessarily equate the two either, would they?
No, that's right. Most scientists who understand the second law of thermodynamics hold that the universe is eventually going to come to heat death. But what they don't recognize often is the extrapolation of this backwards. And that's the point that Van Wylen and his colleagues are emphasizing, that if you extrapolate backwards, you don't need an infinite time in order to reach that point. And thus, if you claim the universe is infinite, that would have already occurred. And that's what forces you to the notion of a creator, or to the notion that this universe is a created entity and doesn't subsist under its own steam. We begin with an apologist who is practically unknown today. He lived in the late 13th century, and therefore was of the same century as Thomas Aquinas, but for everyone who knows of Raymond Lull, there are hundreds and thousands who know of Thomas Aquinas. Lull has been pretty largely forgotten. The last name is spelled L-U-L-L, sometimes L-U-L-L-I-U-S, the Latin form of his name. His first name, Raymond, and that appears in various forms of the name Raymond, sometimes as Raymond spelled R-A-I-M-U-N-D, sometimes the standard English spelling of Raymond, other times the Spanish Ramon, R-A-M-O-N, with an acute accent over the O. And why should his first name be given occasionally in a Spanish form? Very simple, he was Spanish. Indeed, he was Catalan, C-A-T-A-L-A-N. He was from the Catalan province of Spain. And as some of you probably know, the Catalan province is one of the ethnic provinces of Spain that has its own language. The Catalan language is sometimes regarded as a dialect of Spanish, but it really is sufficiently different that it's an independent tongue. It's as different from Spanish as Dutch is from German, for example. And Lull is important in the history of Catalan literature, apart from his interest in apologetics, because he wrote in the vernacular, one of the early people writing in the vernacular, and some of his apologetics work was done in the Catalan language. And that, of course, creates problems for the handling of it, unless it's been translated into a well-known European language. Raymond Lull is a person that you might have come across in an entirely different connection, because he is always mentioned in the history of missions. He was the first missionary to the Muslims. Now, we don't mean that nobody ever had any interest in presenting the gospel to Muslims prior to Raymond Lull. We already have spoken about the interest that the Eastern Church had in the defense of the faith over against the Muslims. You recall our favorite Bishop of Haran, whose parable we dealt with another class period. Certainly in the Eastern Church there was contact with Muslims and the defense of the faith over against the Muslim position. But in the West, where as a result of the Dark Ages people were pretty much cut off from contact with other religions, there was very little done in defending the faith against non-Christian positions in the Middle Ages, and very little missionary work done. People in Western Europe were hanging on to their own faith in the midst of barbarian invasions, mangy Scandinavians, Vikings, who were leaping down from the north and making their life miserable, Huns coming in from the east, etc. All of those problems made it very difficult to engage in a missionary outreach beyond the confines of Europe. Raymond Lull is the first of the Western missionaries to the Muslim world. And it's very interesting that Lull should happen to be an exceedingly important early apologist whose work in the defense of the faith is conjoined with his missionary activity from start to finish. The best book on Lull in English is one which unfortunately is now out of print and has been out of print for a half a century. It was written by Samuel Zwamer, the great Presbyterian missionary to the Muslims early in this century. The book is entitled Raymond Lull, First Missionary to the Muslims by Samuel M. Zwamer. If you are Presbyterian, you certainly have heard of Zwamer, and you may well have heard of him even if you aren't Presbyterian, because he carried on the most aggressive and attractive missionary effort to Muslims at the beginning of our century. Zwamer took Lull as a kind of model, and this book sets forth the importance of Lull for missions and also for apologetics. There's another place where you might have come across him. If you, by any slim chance, majored in philosophy and took a course in the history of logic, you would have come across Lull, because he developed certain logical techniques that were forerunners of the Venn diagrams, the V-E-N-N diagrams used for the solution of formal syllogisms in Aristotelian classical logic. So he turns up in various places, but not very strongly. He's one of those people who didn't have a major impact on the general history of thought, but who touched various realms at various points. Still another place where you might conceivably have come across him is in the literary history of the occult, because these strange diagrams that he developed for purposes of logic were interpreted at certain centuries as being mystical diagrams for the evocation of spirits. And so Lull is classified by the maniacal type of occultist as in a secret tradition. You see, he somehow had secret esoteric knowledge which he passed on to generations beyond him through word of mouth, this kind of nonsense. That is the way in which most histories of the occult by occultists are built up. Anything that could have an occult flavor is automatically assumed to have an occult flavor, and then you get these strange mystical connections from century to century. A good deal of the history of the Masons, the Masonic order, is built up that way. So you might possibly have come across Lull in that connection. The fact that he combined apologetics and missions is another illustration of the intimate connection between these two fields. I want to stress that connection, because so often, particularly in pietistic circles, an effort is made to set missionary work over against apologetics. Missionary work shows spirituality, while apologetics shows a cold and arid type of personality, one which would not have an interest in the proclamation of Christian faith. Raymond Lull, 13th century, is an excellent indication that this stereotype just can't be maintained. The fact of the matter is, as we pointed out in dealing with Paul's approach to the defense of the faith on Mars Hill, the central principle of becoming all things to all men, getting on to a common ground with the unbeliever, is at the root both of missions and of apologetics. It's the same fundamental motif. The idea is that unless you're willing to take the same position as the non-Christian, whether in a missionary sense or in an apologetic sense, you won't be able to help him at the point of his particular difficulty. So this common principle of becoming all things to all men infuses the defense of the faith and also the missionary effort, and the best of Christian missions has for that reason been very much concerned with the best of apologetic thinking, Lull being a fine example of this. I want to give you some material from Samuel Zwamer's treatment of Lull so that you get an idea as to his significance in these two realms. Says Zwamer, "The reasonableness and demonstrability of Christianity is the real basis of Lull's method. Nothing Lull held,
interfered more with the spread of Christian truth than the attempt of its advocates to represent its doctrines as undemonstrable mysteries. That makes you think a bit of Tertullian, credo quia absurdum. Lull would have none of that. For him, the Christian faith was not to be presented as an enigma wrapped in a mystery, as a kind of reflection of that theologian searching for a black cat in a pitch black cellar, which may or may not be there. His perspective was anything but that sort of thing. The very difference, continues Zwemer, the very difference between Christ and Antichrist lies, in Lull's opinion, in the fact that the former can prove his truth by miracles, while the latter cannot. Again, we see the argument for miracle, which is, of course, fundamental since the apostolic period. The glory of Christianity, Lull argues, is that it does not maintain the undemonstrable, but simply the supernatural. He makes a distinction here between what is beyond immediate sensory contact and what is undemonstrable. He claims that merely because something is above and beyond the realm of immediate sensory contact doesn't eliminate its demonstrability in principle. Christianity, for Lull, is not against reason, but above unsanctified reason. The distinction here between irrational and suprarational. The demonstration that Lull seeks is not that of ordinary logic. He says that we require a method which will reason not only from effect to cause, or from cause to effect, but per aequipontiam, which means by each of these simultaneously. What Lull is trying to do here is to get beyond the position of Aquinas, who insisted on a strict Aristotelian logic operating either deductively or inductively. Lull is trying to find some way of dealing with rational questions that will go beyond the traditional Aristotelian logic. And in particular, he attempts to show that contrary attributes can exist together in one subject, so that in order to do this, it becomes necessary to go beyond a strict Aristotelian logic into what he calls a universal art of discovery. The major work that Lull did was called the Ars Major, the major art, and this was an attempt to arrive at a logic, if you will, a logic that would transcend the Aristotelian logic as relied upon by Aquinas. You can see throughout what Lull does that he's attempting to react to the standard philosophical, theological position of his time. Everybody was going Aristotelian by way of Aquinas' Summa, and Lull feels that there must be a way of moving beyond this. He apparently saw that there were deficiencies in the method of Aquinas in the Summa Contra Gentiles with reference to missionary work. You couldn't simply deal with Muslims on the basis of the Aristotelian patterns that Aquinas had set up. Lull's Ars Major is a tabulation of the different points of view from which propositions may be framed about objects. It's worthwhile giving you an example or so of this so that you at least get the idea as to how Lull operated. If you deal with Latin, the Latin language, or you deal with the Arabic language, you are involved immediately in terminations of the words, inflections, on the basis of which the words function in their sentences. Those of you who have had German will know a bit of what we're talking about here. And of course, as far as conjugations are concerned, this is something present in the Romance languages as well. We in English have been moving away from an inflectional system to the point where word order
creates meaning for us to a far, far greater extent than any kind of inflectional endings. But in the languages that Lowell was dealing with, inflectional endings were vital. If you know your roots and you know your sets of inflectional endings, in theory, you can combine these to produce any distinct and definite grammatical result. Lowell takes this as a model and argues that that should be the case philosophically and metaphysically.
That should be the case for determining the nature of the world. You ought to be able to isolate the elements of the world, and then by taking these elements in various combinations, you should be able to predict all possible results and eliminate those results which are inappropriate. By a knowledge of the different types of existence and their possible relations and combinations, we should possess knowledge of the whole of nature, Lowell was convinced, and of all truth as a system. Now here's a concrete example of how he does this. The great art begins by laying down an alphabet, according to which the 9 letters from B to K stand for the different kinds of substances and attributes. He simply lists the letters from B to K, and various kinds of substances and attributes are attached to or represented by these letters. Thus, in the series of substances, B stands for God,
C for angel, D for heaven, E for man, and so on. By substance, he means the various kinds of beings that exist in the universe. Now, that
as far as substances are concerned. In the series of attributes, these same letters represent other things. B represents goodness. D represents duration. C represents greatness, etc. Or again, you can take this series of letters to represent the standard questions of scholastic philosophy. In that case, B stands for utrum, whether. C stands for quid, what. D stands for de quo, the source, and so on. Now, by manipulating these letters in such a way as to show the relationship of different objects and predicates, you exercise Lowell's new art. You could, for example, take concentric circles, and you could put the letters A to, or the letters B to K around the circumference of the circles. Suppose you took a small circle like this, with these letters around it, and you centered it on a larger circle and did the same thing around the circumference of it, and so forth for a third or a fourth circle. Then, if you pivoted these circles at the center point, you could then turn each circle, bringing different letters into alignment with each other. When you were knee-high to a grasshopper, didn't you use secret codes as a child? As a child, you used a system something like this, where, for example, you put all the letters of the alphabet around an outside circle and then all letters of the alphabet around an inner circle, and you turned the inner circle, and then whatever letters matched up, you would substitute the code letter for the ordinary letter. All right? You can think of this sort of thing. And actually, Lowell's great art in the early published editions consisted of such circle diagrams along with explanations. These circle diagrams were actually put in. I have a 17th century edition of Lowell, which I did not bring tonight, but that edition is one that was published in Strasbourg by Zetzner in the 17th century, and it's one of the editions that had not yet been cut by the booksellers. And the sheets are still in, which are to be cut apart for these circles and fixed in the permanent pages so as to create such diagrams. Now, it was Lowell's conviction that by manipulating these circles, these figures or geometrical arrangements, that you could arrive at all possible combinations of reality. You could eliminate meaningless questions and you could end up with those questions that had substantival significance. Now we say, great Scott, that is utterly naive. For one thing, there are far too many attributes or characteristics in the universe to permit any exhaustive list. For another thing, you couldn't categorize these in such a fashion as to get exclusive categories and arrive at definite conclusions. Well, certainly that kind of objection is easy for us at the present time. It wasn't as easy for Lowell to recognize, owing to the fact that the categories of thought were much more definitely fixed in his time than they are in ours. He picks up the categories of thought which, as a matter of fact, Aristotle supplied to his time, principally by way of Aquinas. The very fact that he uses the standard questions of scholastic philosophy illustrates this. He sees the world very largely in terms of those limited characteristics and those limited questions. Even though he is trying desperately to get beyond such limited questions to a wider view than the Aristotelian Thomistic system permitted. His materia, the stuff of his system, comes inevitably from exactly the same source as Aquinas, namely from Aristotle. In the 13th century, virtually everything came from Aristotle. But his manner of dealing with this material is an attempt to go well beyond the strictly limited traditional proofs for the existence of God that Aquinas took over from Aristotle. It's his conviction that by one arrangement of circles, you can get all possible combinations of the attributes of God. Also, all possible conditions for the existence of the soul. And these figures are further fenced about by definitions and rules. Their use is further specified by various multiplications, he calls them, multiplicaciones, which show us how to exhaust all possible combinations and sets of questions which the terms of our proposition admits. After discussing this, Zwemer says, the Lullian method of a wheel within a wheel seems at first as perplexing as the visions of Ezekiel and as puerile as the automatic book machine in Gulliver's Travels. But it would be unfair to say that Lull supposed that, quote, and here he's citing an earlier critic of Lull, thinking could be reduced to a mere rotation of pasteboard circles, unquote, or that his art enabled men, quote, to talk without judgment of that which they did not know, unquote. Lull, says Zwemer, sought to give not a compendium of knowledge, but a method of investigation. He sought a more scientific method for philosophy than the dialectic of his contemporaries. In his conception of a universal method and his application of the vernacular languages to philosophy, he was a herald of Bacon himself, Francis Bacon, that is, not Roger. In his demand for a reasonable religion, he was beyond his age. And in applying this system, weak though it was, to the conversion of infidels, he proved himself the first missionary philosopher. He perceived the possibilities, though not the limitations, of comparative theology and the science of logic as weapons for the missionary. If you feel that this is utterly without contemporary influence or possibility, you should realize that Lull is not only mentioned in histories of logic in connection with the background of the Venn diagrams, but he is also mentioned in the background history of contemporary computer technique. There is a text on computer technique which is quite widely used and which has a historical chapter, and quite a bit of attention is given to Lull's diagrams in this section. And you may be interested to know that the Christian Research Institute is endeavoring to work out an apologetic system on computer which will make it possible to retrieve the most significant answers to objections to the Christian faith through the centuries. The program that goes into such a computer has alignments with the sort of thing that Lowell was attempting. It doesn't suffer from the naivete of Lowell's method in thinking that you can exhaust all conceivable questions. You see, Lowell would have come out, theoretically, with an eternal apologetic, with an apologetic that would apply equally to all situations and all conditions. There isn't any such apologetic, because conditions constantly change. The method of the Christian Research Institute is not to attempt a permanent, absolute apologetic, but to employ the interrelation of concepts in the programming of the computer so as to retrieve a maximal amount of relevant apologetic information for the contemporary scene. And the program obviously can be modified as time goes on. Lowell also engaged in literary apologetics. And it's not very common in the history of this discipline to find a person who is as interested in literature as he is in logic. This is not to say that all literary writers are illogical, nor to say that all logicians are uncreative, but the fact is, the descriptive fact is, that people tend either to do apologetics for the tough-minded, to use William James' expression, or to do apologetics for the tender-minded. They either engage in a strict, logical type of proof, on the one hand, or they engage in an allegorical or mythical literary style apologetic for people who are feeling their way into the Christian faith. Relatively few apologists in the history of the discipline have managed to do both. Lowell was one of them. The best modern example of this sort of thing is, of course, C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, whose Mere Christianity, Miracles, Problem of Pain, provide the tough-minded type of apologetic, and whose science fiction trilogy, Narnian Chronicles, etc., offer the literary side of the picture. In the case of Lowell, you have these two sides operating as well. On the literary side, he produced an allegorical novel called Blanquerna, B-L-A-N-Q-U-E-R-N-A. B-L-A-N-Q-U-E-R-N-A, Blanquerna. This is the name of the leading character in the novel. This was written in Catalan, in the Spanish dialect of Catalan. And it has been translated into English from Catalan, the whole of it. It is no longer in print. Apparently, people did not trample each other getting it at their neighborhood bookstores. So you have to consult this in a major library, but it is able to be consulted. I obtained a Xerox of the whole thing from the Library of Congress because it seemed hopeless to try and get it otherwise. Blanquerna is regarded as the greatest allegory, the greatest apologetic allegory of the medieval period. It's in many ways a predecessor in style to Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. Now, that does not say that Bunyan relied upon it. In fact, the studies of Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress have come up with almost nothing as to literary sources. Bunyan spun Pilgrim's Progress out of his very soul. The source critics have had a terrible time with Bunyan. They just haven't been able to find anybody they can pin it on, and they also have not found it possible to dismember it and argue that it was the product of later editors or anything like that. Fact is that Bunyan was in jail with nothing else to do, and while he was in jail, he spun Pilgrim's Progress out of his very being, like the spider spins his web. But in style, in literary style, especially in the use of allegory to bring across Christian truth, Blanquerna parallels Pilgrim's Progress. Lowell has this to say of his work in Blanquerna. He says, "We see the pilgrim traveling away to distant lands to seek thee, O God, though thou art so near that every man, if he would, might find thee in his own house and chamber. The pilgrims are so deceived by false men, whom they meet in taverns and churches, that many of them, when they return home, show themselves to be far worse than they were when they set out." Interesting, eh? This reminds one more of Lewis's Pilgrim's Regress than it does of Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. Here, Lowell recognizes that a pilgrimage does not automatically lead to positive religious results. Regardless of what Simon and Garfunkel have to say, wandering from Berkeley to Carmel does not ipso facto mean an answer to universal problems. It can mean only that you become more and more cloudy, which I believe is the name of the tune. And it's perceptive, it seems to me, that Lowell would see that as pilgrims wander around, their problems can be increased not only in taverns, but also in churches. Churches are not ipso facto a solution to people's problems, any more than taverns are. Now, the two, in a sense, can be placed in a similar category, neither offering necessarily the answer to what one wants. At the beginning of Auden's Age of Anxiety, his characters are in a Third Avenue bar. That was at the time when the Third Avenue L was still around in New York. And people figured that there, somehow, in the atmosphere of the constant movement of trains and the transitional elements of contemporary civilization, answers would come. Well, they didn't really come, and Auden tries to emphasize that in the Age of Anxiety. He says, they sat there and they obliterated the problem through their own discussion. And Lowell is saying somewhat the same sort of thing in Blancherna. The first and foremost in any search for religious truth, says he, is the real desire to find the answers. If you don't have that, you can go on pilgrimages from now until the cows come home, and there is no guarantee of any positive results. Raymond Lowell, then, is an apologist who deserves to be rehabilitated. He would make a glorious doctoral dissertation if you could find a doctoral committee that you could persuade to permit you to write in English, that is to say, in communicative English, while doing your dissertation. The result could be a book of considerable consequence. Incidentally, one of the values of considering seriously a European doctorate is that you can write your dissertation as a book rather than as a manual to conform to the dissertation secretary's requirements. There is nothing the matter with conforming to a dissertation secretary's requirements. The only difficulty is that when you've completed this thing, it isn't publishable anywhere. In 99 and 44 100% of the cases. You can split it up and publish it as individual journal articles, but of course that's a problem if it turns out that each chapter will not stand by itself. Some people have suggested, though, that you ought to try to do that if you possibly can, because then you immediately have 10 items in your bibliography instead of having only one. So there is that theory in the matter. But regardless, Raymond Lowell could stand careful scholarly treatment and rehabilitation for our present century. Let's move beyond the defense of the faith in the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. And here we want to emphasize that the philosophical position of greatest consequence again becomes the philosophical position of Plato, or better, Neoplatonism. You recall that Augustine defended Christianity in terms of the categories of Platonic philosophy. Aquinas defended the Christian faith by way of the categories of Aristotelian philosophy. The Renaissance is very largely a reaction to the Middle Ages. Look at the section in my book, The Shape of the Past, dealing with the Renaissance for its relationship to the Middle Ages. Because the Renaissance reacts against medieval thought patterns, it picks up the other major philosopher of classical times, which the Middle Ages largely neglected, namely Plato. But the Plato who is picked up by the Renaissance is a Plato interpreted mystically, a Neoplatonic Plato, if you will. The Plato of Philo the Jew, the Plato of Porphyry, those interpreters of Plato in the later years of the Roman Empire, just before the fall of Rome. You must think back then to what we had to say about the apologetic of St. Augustine, if you want to understand what goes on during the Renaissance in the defense of the faith. You recall that one of the major themes in Augustine is the theme of our hearts being restless until they rest in God. The great prayer at the beginning of Augustine's Confessions, "Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee." This is the notion of man having a need that can only be satisfied by contact with the divine. Any other contact is going to be less than satisfactory. The technical term for this kind of approach is axiological. Axiological, axiological. This is an axiological apologetic, an axiological approach to the defense of the faith. This comes from the Greek word axios, meaning value or worth. Valuable or worthy, the adjective. It means an approach to the defense of the faith in terms of values. And Augustine is saying, on the basis of Plato, that when you try to find value in your life, you don't find it there. And you need something beyond yourself to supply that value. And ultimately, the only way in which you're going to get those longings satisfied is by way of God. We referred to this also as the God-shaped blank, the theory of the God-shaped blank, that there is a hole in every man's heart which can only be filled by one thing or one person. Like a picture puzzle with one piece missing and the piece is in the shape of a cross. In the Renaissance, the defense of the faith takes off from this kind of perspective. And a striking example of it is the apologetic side of Thomas More's Utopia. This is More, the Man for All Seasons. In the title of Robert Bolt's magnificent modern play, dealing with More. Sir Thomas More was indeed a man for all seasons. He was a man of many parts. He was Lord High Chancellor of England under Henry VIII. And who was the Lord High Chancellor? Well, the Lord High Chancellor was the highest judicial official on the equity side of English jurisprudence. English law and American law also is divided into two main legal systems, the system of common law and the system of equity. Equity developed because of the hardness and stiffness of the common law. It was necessary to go beyond the stiffness of common law to deal with certain problems that couldn't be dealt with in terms of the sclerotic character of common law. So an approach was developed called equity. This originally was simply an appeal to the king for mercy in a situation where the common law would not adequately deal with a person's need, where no remedy was available within the common law. A system of equity arose, and the chancellor, who had originally been the chaplain and secretary to the king, took over the function of dealing with equity cases. And so finally, you got a Lord High Chancellor who was the final court of appeal in equity cases, as, for example, on the law side of the dualism, you had the court of the King's Bench serving to make ultimate decisions. Thomas More was a lawyer. He was trained as a lawyer in civil law, much more than in canon law and church law, and his career was spent in that capacity. And Moore went to the Tower because he would not place a juridical stamp of approval on Henry VIII's dumping of Henry's wife, Catherine of Aragon, for Anne Boleyn. You can say what you will about Henry's bedtime activities. They are certainly not the most commendable aspect of history, but the king was trying to get a male heir. This was his object. In order to continue the dynasty, he wanted to obtain a special indulgence from the papacy to permit a second marriage, and he did not receive this. The reason why he didn't receive it was that Catherine was a cousin of Emperor Charles V, and Emperor Charles V was much closer to the papacy, physically, geographically, than was Henry VIII. And Charles V said, "You are not going to make a dishonest woman out of my cousin, and we're going to have none of that nonsense." And the Pope said, "You have a point there," and the request was denied to permit Henry to divorce his wife and to marry Anne Boleyn. Then, of course, Henry turned to the most prestigious juridical influence in his kingdom for an imprimatur. He wanted an imprimatur nihil obstat placed upon his forehead by someone. The Pope would not do it, and so Thomas More was the obvious person. But More wouldn't do it either. Henry couldn't get at the Pope, but he could get at More, and More went to the Tower as a result of this. More was one of the most attractive figures in the church history of England at the time of the Renaissance and the Reformation. I must say that if I had to choose between Henry and Thomas More, I wouldn't hesitate a moment, regardless of any theological questions involved. More certainly dealt with the area in terms of principle to a much greater extent than Henry. Henry was consistent, but he was pragmatically consistent. More was consistent, he was doctrinally, theologically consistent. The greatest literary work that More did is his Utopia. This is by no means all he did. The Yale edition of the writings of Sir Thomas More is coming out now. It is almost completed. It's a magnificent critical edition and presents any number of works by More. But the Utopia is the only one that we're going to be referring to here. The Utopia gave that word to the English language. On no place, but also a place where all was well. There is a play on the Greek in this term. And More sets forth there the story of a hypothetical island, a society which Westerners come across in sailing in the voyages of exploration that were so characteristic of this time. This is, in general, the time of Columbus, Balboa, and so on. And an English ship lands on the island of Utopia, and there are people who have never heard of Christianity. Their society, in terms of natural development, is in many ways superior to Western society. More uses this motif to show up the difficulties of his own society. But the people are not Christian, and they realize that there is something fundamentally lacking in their own religious life. When the Utopians go to bed at night, they pray. And they pray a prayer which I will quote out of the Utopia, if I can find the text thereof. If not, I will have to paraphrase it, but I feel sure it's here somewhere. Yes, it is here somewhere. If there be any other religion better than that in Utopia, being more acceptable to God, We desire Him, God, that He will of His goodness let us have knowledge thereof, as one that is ready to follow what way soever He will lead him. Once more, if there be any other religion better than that in Utopia, being more acceptable to God, we desire Him that He will of His goodness let us have knowledge thereof, as one that is ready to follow whatsoever way He will lead him. The translation is a little bit rough, but you certainly get the idea. The Utopians are well aware that they need something that they don't already have, and any success in their social alignments has not taken care of their inner and personal longings. So they pray that the word will come to them of something better than what they presently have. This they pray. The Westerners arrive, they present Christianity, the Utopians say exactly what we have been looking for, exactly what we need, and the Utopians are converted to Christianity. This is very interesting because Moore did this at the time of the discoveries. And what he's saying is that people everywhere have the same need, the need for the Christian gospel. And therefore, our object is to help them to come into contact with it. If they're honest about their own needs, they'll recognize that the answers to these needs do in fact come within the framework of Christian faith. The approach here parallels in many ways the approach that St. Paul took on the Areopagus. This is Paul saying to the Stoic philosophers, as your own poets have said, and quoting these poets to the effect that the world very definitely is the product of divine activity, the question simply being, who is this unknown God that they're putting up idols to? Moore says, if we take the gospel out to people, and we help them to see where their need genuinely lies, there will be a matching up between this need and the answers that Christian faith offers. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that people may analyze their needs in such a way that these needs will be used to justify a different kind of solution from the Christian faith. We talked about this a bit when we were discussing the Eastern parabolic analogy for apologetics offered by our favorite Bishop of Haran. We emphasized that when people examine their own situation, they can, if they're not careful, look at problems they have from such an angle that this will block them off from solutions. Concretely, suppose you begin talking with someone about Christian faith, and you say, what is your greatest need? The person says, a Porsche. I don't have a Porsche. That's my greatest need. All I have is an MG. Now, if the person persists in that lame-brained analysis of the meaning of life, you are going to have considerable difficulties in getting across Christian faith. Christian faith will not appear to be an answer to that problem, because it isn't an answer to that problem. You're going to have to help the person to see that, as a matter of fact, his need strikes a bit deeper than that level. And the problem with the Platonic, Augustinian, Utopian approach is that it may not, with sufficient sophistication, deal with the person's understanding of his own need. It may too readily accept the person's own analysis of his need. But with that qualification, the point is very, very well taken, it seems to me, and Moore is quite attractively presenting something that missionaries have found through the centuries. The missionary very often does beat his way through the bush There he finds a native people that has had no contact with Christianity, but which, by way of its rites and ceremonies, has seen the need for precisely what the Christian faith is offering. I'll give you an illustration of this, which is a true story. I know a retired serviceman who was an officer stationed in the Philippines. And while he was in the Philippines as a Christian on his time off, he went up into the hills and had contact with certain tribes that were well out of the framework of the ordinary civilized atmosphere there in the Philippines. He was a bit of an anthropologist, a very, very well-trained person, and he got to know this particular tribe exceedingly well. And after he had acquired a speaking knowledge of their language and had gained their confidence, they introduced him to a number of practices that they had which were not known outside of their own circles. These people had not been approached by any Christian missions at all. And, among other things, they put blood above their doorposts in order to make sure that death and sin would pass over their houses and not corrupt their own families. Now, you see, where does this kind of thing arise? Carl Gustav Jung would say, one of the archetypes of the collective unconscious, surely, because a similar doorpost blood operation takes place thousands and thousands of miles away with no cultural connections in the case of the Israelites. But again, there is a simpler explanation of this, surely. The explanation simply is that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. And people know this. They know it. It's part of their very being. And therefore, when Christian faith brings a gospel where God Almighty has given Himself and has shed His blood for them, there is a response that appears. Often the objections to Christian faith are objections that have arisen through a refined attempt to argue against what we already know to be true. It is not always the case that the best arguments against the Christian faith are arguments that are universal and easily come upon by everybody. It is more often the case that the more powerful arguments against Christian faith are developed arguments, and arguments that go against what Scripture describes as people's native way of looking at the world. Eh? The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. It takes a certain amount of sophistication to arrive at a contrary view in an area like that. We're not saying that the arguments are all nonsense, hardly. We're simply saying that the arguments are not natural. All right, the arguments are not natural. My good friend R.C. Sproul of the Ligonier Valley Study Center has done a book published by Bethany, my publisher, and this book is entitled The Psychology of Atheism, a very interesting work in which he argues that there are inevitably and invariably sociological and psychological reasons for atheism that are more powerful than the arguments presented by the atheist. This is, of course, turning the standard criticism of the Christian faith on its head, because the standard technique is to say to you, so you're a believer. I wonder what it was in your childhood that brought you into that unfortunate condition. You see, did your mother drop you on your head when you were a baby? Or what happened that would have actually produced belief? The point that Sproul makes is that it's more rational to ask that question of the unbeliever than it is to ask it of the believer, because belief is more natural than unbelief. And the recognition of human need relative to an area like this is much more natural than the denial of such need. Let's take a look at one other apologist of the Renaissance period. This is a Spaniard by the name of Luis Vives, V-I-V-E-S. He was a friend of Thomas More, and on his death, he left the first modern treatise on apologetics built on a Catholic foundation. It's the first modern treatise of Catholic apologetics. You say, why do you suddenly introduce the word Catholic? Well, because later on this evening, I'm going to talk about Hugo Grotius in the 17th century, who did the first Protestant work on apologetics, the first Protestant textbook, and there are differences in that Grotius' work is based upon a Reformation attitude toward theology, while Vivas' work is based upon what certainly must be regarded as a Roman Catholic view. The title of Vivas' work was De Veritate Fide Christianae, On the Truth of the Christian Faith. That's not especially distinctive. Just about all of the apologists who have ever written have titled their books something like that. Apologists don't have much imagination. That's perfectly plain. That title has been used by everybody and his brother, De Veritate Fide Christianae. This was published in 1543, which makes it a work of the very end of the Renaissance period. Vivas is another illustration of the extent to which Plato and Platonic thinking influence Christian defense in this period. Vivas did a commentary on Augustine's City of God. That commentary was done in 1522. And as a result of this, he was led to ponder the arguments from miracle and prophecy, because the arguments from miracle and prophecy are included by Augustine in his City of God. In Augustine's City of God, miracle and prophecy are dealt with in books 19 and 22. Vivas goes on from there to do his own independent work of Christian defense. And what makes this so modern is that he starts with the end or purpose of man. This is Augustine's, our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. What is man's end or purpose? What's he here for? What's he really doing with his life? And he goes on from that question of the end of man to a consideration notice of primitive religion. What sort of religion do we find among the primitives? And having set forth the character of primitive religion, he then emphasizes how Christ is the answer to it. The messiahship of Christ, the finality of Christ's mission, are exactly what man needs. He sets the finality of Christ's mission over against the Muslim view that Jesus was a great prophet, but not the final answer. Why should Vivas be dealing with Muslims? Well, not only the fact that Raymond Lull preceded him and gave him some ground for doing it, but more important, the fact that Vivas and Lull are both Spaniards. And it was in Spain that the Muslims were being forced out during the entire Middle Ages. The Reconquista, the reconquest of Spain from the Muslims that went on through the whole Middle Ages, gave Spanish Christians a sensitivity to the preaching of the gospel to Muslims. In the last paragraph of Vivas' work, he goes back to a principle that Clement of Alexandria, one of the early church fathers, took from Plato. And the principle is, the more Christian a man is, the more the Christian is like unto God. The final argument in Vivas' work is that the Christian can be an apology for Christianity himself. The more Christian a man is, the more people will see God in him and therefore be led to an acceptance of him. Now, before I go on to the Reformation, I want to recommend a book or two relating to some of the people we've been talking about. There is a short book, very short book, series of lectures running only about 100 pages, done by one of the greatest Roman Catholic theologians of modern times, Étienne Gilson, G-I-L-S-O-N, first name Étienne, E-T-I-E-N-N-E. This book is entitled Reason and Revelation in the Middle Ages. It was a series of lectures at the University of Virginia some years ago. The book is in print. It's published by Scribner's. And it discusses the defense of the faith from Augustine on to the time of the Reformation. It does not deal with the Reformation. Gilson is Roman Catholic. His attitude toward the Reformation, of course, is not very positive. But his approach to the defense of the faith in the period that we've just been dealing with is very, very helpful. There he shows how Augustine reacted to Plato, Aquinas reacted to Aristotle, and the Renaissance again reacts to Plato. And he gives other illustrations of the same kind of thing. He gets into Roger Bacon, the founder of modern empirical science, at the end of the Middle Ages, and shows how his ideas interrelate. If you'd like a fascinating and lucid treatment of the way in which reason and revelation were interrelated by Christian thinkers from Augustine on to the end of the Middle Ages, this is certainly the book to get a hold of. Gilson also did a work entitled The Spirit of Medieval Philosophy, which is a more detailed work and goes beyond the purposes of this course, but he is one of the writers that you should be well acquainted with. And then we spent a little time on Anselm, on St. Anselm, Anselm's ontological proof for the existence of God, and there are two works that I'd like to mention on Anselm for those of you who think you would be interested in doing something more with him. The finest biography of Anselm, in my opinion, is a work done by a 19th century scholar who was an attorney and who was very interested in the logical side of Anselm's work. The author is J.M. Rigg, R-I-G-G, J.M. Rigg. The title of the work, Anselm of Canterbury, a chapter in the history of religion. This was published in London in 1896. It is out of print, but it's obtainable, and a very, very valuable book. Then, for a brief summary of Anselm's thought, there is no better work than this very slight volume of some 50 pages, Gerald P. Phelan, P-H-E-L-A-N, Gerald B. Phelan, P-H-E-L-A-N, The Wisdom of St. Anselm. This was a series of lectures, and the publisher is the Ark Abbey Press, the Ark Abbey Press in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. It was distributed by University Publishers in New York City. Very often, series of lectures can give you a helpful overview of a difficult thinker that you would find it much harder to obtain in other ways.